Hi, welcome to Masonic Central on our weekly podcast here. Sorry, I forgot where we were. Today's October 12th, 2008. This is a weekly podcast show for Freemasons by Freemasons, hosted to explore the depths of the Masonic world. If you're new to our program, visit our website at masoniccentral.com or send us an email at masoniccentral@gmail.com. And if you send us an email, we read it on the air. We'll send you out some free bumper stickers so you can help us talk about and advertise the show. This is a live program where you, the listeners, can interact and contribute to the conversations, or you can just follow along the conversations live at the call-in or later on as a download podcast. If you're following along, sometimes we have interactive chats where you, the audience, can actually jump in and ask us questions. Something I want to mention briefly is that all this content is representative of our own opinions of us and the contributors and does not represent any of the opinions of any regular or irregular Masonic body or Grand Masonic Lodge. So it's something that's coming from us. Further, that Masonic Central is not here for a particular agenda or for recruitment, more just to talk about Freemasonry. My name is Greg Stewart. I host a couple of websites coming on the blogosphere, and this is my co-host, Dean. How you doing tonight, Dean?
Not bad. And yourself, Greg?
I'm doing great.
I'm doing still great. Here. That's a big surprise for anyone following the story. I am here still. Haven't been
Dean yet. Dean's wife has not given birth yet, so anybody who's listening along live with us or at a close time to our podcast, Dean is not a papa number three now. So it's pretty close, huh, Dean? You getting nervous? More diaper change and that's a silly question to ask.
Change subjects, Greg.
Absolutely, absolutely. Actually, just one piece of business that I wanted to get into this week. We've been doing our weekly emails, so I wanted to kind of read one of the emails that we got over the last week. And just to remind any brothers who are listening out there, send us an email again, and if we read it on the air, we'll send you out some goodies. This week's email is not really about the show so much, but it's something definitely we can all kind of ponder and maybe even come to and talk about in a future show. The question comes to us from Michael. I'm going to butcher your name, brother, but it's Michael St. Laurent coming to us out of Salt Lake City, Montana, Moriah Lodge number 2, and he's actually a fellow craft. And his question this week in his email is not on a tech issue, which we followed up from last week, but more along the lines of why there's a membership decline going on presently in North America. And his question is being asked, being new, I ask a lot of questions of my lodge brothers. They tell me stories of when hundreds attended lodge meetings, and he's asking us how we can bring back those glory days. So definitely something for all of us to sort of think about, you know, and Brother Michael, I think that we definitely will be touching on that as we start to progress in some of these calls and these shows, and I think we may have some interesting insights, probably nothing terribly new, but I personally think that we're in for a bit of a change, there's going to be a reawakening, I think, of this system. So yeah, thanks for sending that in. Send us your contact info. Actually, I have it here in the email, and I'll forward you out some decals. So this week, we are here October 12th on a Sunday evening, and we have a very special guest with us, Brother Stephen Defoe. Brother Defoe is a prolific author of several Masonic and Templar books, and he's now crossing into the world of graphic novels with a new Templar project called Outreamer. That's due November 1st, and we'll give you the information if you want to pick it up. Brother Defoe, how are you?
I'm good. How are you, sir?
I am very good. I'm very good. Thanks for joining us this week. I really appreciate you coming on and giving us this chance to talk to you about all this. Templars are definitely a big aspect of Freemasonry, and you know, we get a lot of speculation as to what the origins are from, and I'm sure that you'll help us out through some of that and kind of give us a little bit of light as to how this has all come about. I guess the first question I have, who is Stephen Defoe?
Oh, you don't really want to know that. Well, I'm a writer living in Canada, which you've already addressed. I specialize, I guess, book-wise in books on the Templars. Wrote my first one in 1997 with an English writer named Alan Butler, who you may know is currently writing some books with Chris Knight, author of Hiram Key. You know, I do other writing as well, journalism type writing, and of course I'm a Freemason, as you and the listeners probably already know.
Absolutely. Now, I guess, you know, important to mention here, I just in doing the research for the show, I came up with three active websites that you have going on that are tied back to you. And I know that there are others, Justin, that I've come across before. I'm sorry, four. The biggest one, obviously, for anybody who wants to know, StephenDefoe.com, which is a nice website that gives a very good history on you. But you are also the owner of TemplarHistory.com, MasonicDictionary.com,
yes,
and TemplarComics.com now.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure others. Any of that on that list?
Greg, he has a nice Facebook site too.
Oh,
yeah, he's on Facebook too. Yeah.
I have to say, I have not figured out how to use Facebook yet.
That was the 20th century, guys. Come on.
It's the only way I can find out what the rest of my family is doing.
I hear that a lot, actually. That's how I figure out what my wife's doing. She lulled me into it, and I'm spending far too much time on it. So I'll definitely check that out. So any brothers are listening, look for Brother Steven on Facebook.
I have to say, I don't understand this obsession with sending people bananas and martinis on Facebook. What is the deal with that? What am I going to do with a digital banana?
I think that's our way of moving into the modern 21st century technology. We've got to acclimate slowly with bananas and margaritas.
Dude, if I had to send a margarita to you through the mail, the charges would be too high, so we do it virtually.
Do it virtually. There you go.
Yeah. Well, I'm
so
happy to be anyone's friend on Facebook as long as you don't send me a digital banana.
What about dancing bananas? We'll send dancing bananas.
Yeah, I gotta know you first.
Greg, I know you're gonna move along here, but let me ask you a question. You said I don't know how you pronounced his comic, Outremer or something like that. Shouldn't it be Outremer?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, that is. You know what? It's interesting, the title of the comic, and we'll talk about it later, I'm sure. Originally, I had called the comic The Brethren, but a woman named Robin Young, shortly after that, came out with a novel on the Templars, part of a trilogy, and she called her first novel Brethren. So I really didn't want... I didn't want any confusion or any implied similarity between the two, so I renamed it. And Outremer, it's simply the French word for overseas, and that's what the Crusaders referred to the Holy Land as Outremer, the land beyond the sea, and so that's where the title came from.
Very nice. Thanks for that catch there, Dean. My Anglophone American here wanted to automatically go to it as Outremer, which, you know, okay.
Oh, that's how you said it. Oh, my God.
Well, you never know.
That is a bad
but you know what? I really don't care how you pronounce it as long as you ask for it by name at your local comic store.
Absolutely. Well, we'll definitely come back to it. That's actually one of the things that I wanted to talk about in all this. But I guess maybe as a little bit of a precursor to this, I looking through your affiliations, you seem to be affiliated with quite a number of lodges, rites, and bodies. How do you have time to write?
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm not as active in a lot of them as I once was. You know, because I'm busy doing other things for the large part. But you know, I always hate when I hear these interviews or I go to a lodge and they're introducing some, you know, gold chain guy, and they're just rattling off this massive list of dues cards that's in his wall. And I mean, you know, really, at the end of the day, what does it mean? You know, does it mean I have a closet full of colored aprons and too much time on my hands?
I know, you know, so all too often with looking at these and talking to different brothers and just seeing these resumes of affiliations and memberships, and it does cause one to almost boggle the mind to think, my God, how is it that you're able to do all this? And the obvious answer, and I think so many of us kind of get afflicted with, is that you don't. You really have to pick and choose, and you go to what you can and do what you can.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, at the same time, like, let's say, for example, the Masonic Knights Templar. Well, for me to be involved in that, I have to maintain my membership in chapter and maintain my membership in lodge. And so you have that. And in some jurisdictions in the United States, you have to maintain your membership in the cryptic rite. And as I'm given to understand, in other areas, you don't have to be a member of the cryptic rite. So, but no,
yeah.
I don't have time to go to lodge as much as I, you know, might like, and certainly not some of the bodies at all.
I completely know what you mean. As I explained to people that are new coming into it, that are interested, it's as broad as you want to get and as diverse as you want to get. But, you know, if you really wanted to, you could find something to do every night of the week. But I think at certain points, it definitely becomes overkill.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm curious in this. How did you first find your way into Masonry? What was the impetus that led you to it to begin with?
You know, as much emphasis as we put on Washington and Franklin, I don't think anybody really joins Freemasonry because George Washington was a Mason. We join because we know someone that was a Mason. And in my case, it was a man named Frank Gibbs who signed my petition. And Frank and I worked together in the early 1990s. And he was a man that I admired. He was a man that had a lot of integrity. And he's a man that wore a Masonic ring. And I asked him about it. And I thought any organization that would accept a man of that quality as a member is an organization that I should look into. And that's it.
That's truly, that's a beautiful description of it. And so frequently, every brother that we talk to and even pose that question to, how did you come in, it all seems to have that same flavor to it. That it was somebody that you knew and just by knowing them and their affiliation, it was something of interest, which I think is a beautiful testament to the fraternity. That's great.
We can deify Washington, or we can deify Sir John A. Macdonald, our first prime minister, who was a Mason. But we respect our next door neighbor. We respect our uncle or our friend or our coworker. On a more tangible level.
It's definitely the day-to-day affiliations of the people that are close to you. Absolutely. Absolutely. That's great. All right. Well, I'm going to just kind of dive right into this. So now you've written extensively about the Templars, I think is a fair assessment. How was it that you came about such an interest in the Templars? Obviously, having gone through the Masonic lines and all and dug through there, what brought you to where you're at now with your interest in them?
Well, I think we have to take it back to childhood. And actually, the introduction to my current book, it's called The Compasses and the Cross. It's a history of the Masonic Templar Order. The whole introduction, I talk about how as a child in the 1960s, I was just thrilled with the Adam West Batman show. because, you know, here's a character, as cartoonish as that was, but here's a character who stood for right and wrong. And around the time that I was, you know, tuned into the show, my parents always bought me books, and they bought me a child's version of Ivanhoe by Sir Walter Scott. It's a book that makes the Templars out not to be the greatest guys, but it was that whole concept of chivalry. So, you know, pretty soon, instead of running around being Batman, I'm running around with a towel around my neck and a little, you know, cardboard bath towel tube, using it as a sword. And so I developed early on this interest in knights and castles and the Arthurian legends. Then when I became a Freemason, you know, I started to hear about the Templars and so on, and so it just kind of evolved from there. And I read, you know, Robinson's Born in Blood. It was probably the first book on the Templars I read. But the difference was I didn't end there. You know, I kept reading, and, you know, then I needed something to do, so I wrote a book, I guess.
That's probably so true of so many that read those books. Even coming from that youth of Ivanhoe and just getting pulled into that sort of drama or romance to it is the follow up of it. And it's funny that you mentioned reading Born in Blood, but then going beyond that and digging deeper. I'm curious, in just digging deeper, where did you find yourself? Did you ever find yourself reaching out to the Vatican and Rome and asking, or has it been a lot more of just research into what others have done?
It's really kind of a two-phase thing. Excuse me. You know, early on, as I've said quite publicly on my website, in recent years, I've kind of shifted in some of my opinions, some of my approach. I mean, certainly early on, I bought into a lot of the ideas that the popular writers, you know, about digging for treasure and that sort of thing. But the more that I dug into the actual primary source documents, and you don't have to go to the Vatican for them. So many of these have been translated into English, and a good medieval history site has them. And as I dug into this stuff, I started to say, well, wait a minute, this doesn't stack up. How could these guys have time to be digging for buried treasure on the Temple Mount when this battle was going, and this battle was going, and this fight was going over here, and Jerusalem was struggling for manpower? It didn't stack up. So the more I dug into it, the more I began to discredit some of the views that I originally had.
was it that reverse of an epiphany one day where it just suddenly it just doesn't make sense anymore?
I wouldn't say that it was really an epiphany. Like Corey Sigler, I did an interview for Working Tools, and he asked me a similar question. The fellow that interviewed me, and I said, you know, when you're dealing with conventional history, you don't really have those blinding flashes of epiphany that will shake the Masonic institution to its core. Trademark. You don't have those because as you're following it, you're following a line of events that becomes very logical why they fell into place. And when you add a social aspect to it, I mean, we have this tendency to put the Templars on a pedestal, you know, give them a mythical status, but they really were human in every sense of the word. They were susceptible to greed. They were susceptible to pride. And when you factor those things into the historical equation, you know, it just becomes logical why things happened the way they did. And that's what I tried to bring to the table with my last book, Nobly Born. You know, it's a book about the Templars, but it's a book about the Templars set against the world in which they actually live.
That's interesting, you know, because I think we do tend to deify them almost to the point where they become these abstracts of people,
sure.
And activities rather than just being regular guys just like us who have to get up every morning, go to work, and come home at night and make dinner and do all the mundane stuff. You know, we tend to put them in that mythic status, just like a Batman that you mentioned a moment ago.
Well, no, that's right. I mean, you know, it wasn't sliding down the bat pole to the bat cave. I mean, their day was mundane. I mean, you know, they were up at the crack of dawn, gone to church, to the chapel to do prayers, and then they'd come back and polish some armor, and then they'd be back for prayer, and, you know, on and on it went. It was very routine and very mundane. But just to give you an example of how human these guys were, the Templars had a very democratic process of electing a Grand Master. It took, after a Grand Master died or quit, it would take 13 men to elect the new Grand Master. But there was a lot of nepotism. For example, during the time of King Richard I, the Lionheart, a Grand Master was elected who hadn't even been a member when he traveled with Richard to the Holy Land. So there was a lot of political influence from the crowned heads. So and we see this today. So the Templars were really no different.
That's interesting. That's very interesting. Yeah, I mean, that puts them right back on par with being regular people.
And you know what? And I think that makes them all the more interesting when you demystify them. And look at these guys as guys that, you know, got cut, that bled red blood. I think that story is every bit as interesting as the idea that they, you know, found some great secret.
Hold on a second. Hold on. I'm a little confused here. I watched Indiana Jones.
Well, that's because you're Canadian, Dean.
Yeah. Oh, you know that there's a guy sitting there somewhere guarding the treasure, and he's still alive.
Greg,
for anyone that's on Last Crusade, they know what I'm talking about.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I've got to ask then, even with this history and all, and even this regular life going on, in your opinion, do you believe that Freemasonry and the Knight Templars are linked in a physical lineage?
No, not at all. And I don't know that I ever truly did. There was certainly a point in my life where I was more open to the idea. The new book, without giving too much away, the new book traces the history of the Masonic Templars from, you know, the earliest writings about them on through. And all Masonic organizations, whether it's the Craft Lodge or the Chapter or the Scottish Rite, we have what is called a traditional history. And you know what? If you want to know more about the concept of traditional history, read Robert Cooper's book, The Roslyn Hoax, because I think he has put it better than anyone can. But we create these traditional histories, which are fictional histories that paint an allegorical backstory to the Masonic degree. The Masonic Knights Templar are no different. But what happened was our traditional history that was created for the Masonic Templar orders became accepted as history, and then people started writing books accepting that traditional history as factual history, and then we Freemasons went out and read those books, and that became a validation for the myth that we ourselves created.
Like a canonization of the myth. Let's just keep perpetuating it and build on it, and eventually it'll be true.
Yeah.
I have this. Does someone want to chime in? Was that the?
Sure.
Yeah, Greg, Dean. This is Jeff Carter down in Naples, Florida.
Hey Jeff.
Hey, Brother Defoe. I've really enjoyed your writings.
Thank you.
And I have a question for you. What is your take on this recent kind of turnaround with the document that was found in the Vatican concerning the Templars?
Well, the list of questions that topics that we're going to are we getting ahead of ourselves on this, Greg?
No, we actually go ahead and you can answer it. We're kind of in track with the plan, so I think that fits. And just for any of the brothers listening, let me just interject real quick. If you're listening online, let us know that you have a question in the chat window, and we'll definitely come to it. And Jeff, I appreciate you throwing it in, but just so we kind of stay on path. So feel free, go ahead, Stephen, and chime in on that. And yeah, we're fine.
I'll just give a little expansion on this for those that may not know what we're talking about. Last year, on October 13th, was the 700th anniversary of the arrest of the Templars and the downfall of the Templar Order. The Vatican brought out an $8,000 book that has some parchments that were claimed to have been recently discovered. And one of these is a document called the Chinon Parchment, which was part of the papal inquiries that forgave Jacques de Molay and some of the other Templar leaders that accepted them back into the church. And this was presented as this great discovery, but it really wasn't anything new. It had been published in a book called Lives of the Popes that was published in the 1600s. It was known as recently as 1920s. But it got miscataloged in the Vatican, and they dusted it off and sold this book. And I'm sure it's a beautiful book, but they've sold it for $8,000. It really, to people that have studied the Templars, it really isn't anything new. I mean, I've had the document, the English translation of Vox in Excelso, which was the order of Pope Clement V that dissolved the Templars in 1312. I've had that on my website since 1997, 11 years, and in it basically says that the Templars were not guilty of heresy, but rather that their reputation had dropped so much that the church had no other choice but to dissolve the order. So for all the secret Vatican, and secretum really just means private archives, so there really isn't any secret. But, of course, the media just jumped on it, as they do with these things. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you very much.
I you know, and I'm curious with that, and as much as we've built this fantasy with, well, I hate to use the word fantasy because it's kind of harsh, but as much as we've built this myth around it, how do you think that it's worked its way into Masonry and to the point where we have degrees and then start to look at it? I mean, do you think that it was just trying to build that lineage, or were we just trying to connect to something in the past, or do you think there was something more to it? Do you think there was really just trying to construct that?
Well, here's the story that I trace in the compasses and the cross. If we start out with the early writers, and I'm talking James Anderson and guys like that, early on, you know, we have this traditional history that Freemasonry dates back to the time of Adam in the Garden of Eden, and that was done for obvious reasons. We want to make Freemasonry time immemorial. But following up on that, we start to see the idea of the Crusaders being introduced into the Masonic story, that the Crusaders were taught Masonic secrets in the Holy Land. Again, to give Freemasonry an older pedigree than it really has. It's not really until Freemasonry starts to branch out into France that we start to see the Templars involved. And a lot of listeners will be familiar with Andrew Michael Ramsey, the author of what's known as the Ramsey Oration. 1737-1738, Ramsey is a Scottish Mason. He's living in France. He's trying to sell Freemasonry to the French, the upper crust. These are guys that are not going to be interested in belonging to a group that's come down from rough-handed stonemasons. So Ramsey introduces the idea that Freemasonry is connected with the Crusaders, not the Templars, the Hospitallers. This was a rival order to the Templars. This appealed to the French more so than, you know, a bunch of stonemasons. But Ramsey never mentions the Templars, and interestingly enough, Ramsey may or may not have actually delivered this speech. Regardless, the idea kind of catches on, and then within the decade, we're seeing the existence of von Huhn's The Rite of Strict Observance, which is a Templar-style degree. And then from there, it evolves and evolves until today, where wearing Civil War uniforms in the United States and mantles in Canada. And that wasn't a knock. I also get into that in the book, too, how different Masonic Templarism is in the different countries. But so if you follow the chain of events, you know, one thing kind of leads into the other. But there's no direct connection. There's no missing link.
Okay. Just waiting. Well, you were talking. Greg accidentally got dropped off the call, and he's coming back on now. So,
did you want me to repeat myself?
No, you did a great job. I'm just waiting now for my key host to come back on the show.
Sorry about that. I hope I didn't leave any dead air there midstream.
Do you know what? He did remarkable well. He kept going and explaining himself. It went rather well while you were trying to get back on, Greg. This is
welcome
great.
Back, Greg.
Is,
yes.
that a polite, is that a polite way of saying I'm long-winded?
I never said anything.
You're good at vamping. That's great.
And just so you guys know, he's lives in Alberta. Alberta in Canada is like the equivalent of Texas in the United States. So, you know.
Yes. Yeah.
So, I missed that answer completely. So, I'm just going to continue on with the flow as if nothing ever happened. And I'm actually, I want to just kind of switch
Here,
gears
Greg,
a little bit.
Greg,
yo,
Greg, I'll give you the condensed version. The idea, okay, you ready for this? The idea that Freemasonry and the Knights Templar of old are connected is BS. There you go.
I have to tell you, Stephen, I kind of already believe that anyways. You know, I just in my opinion, not to inject my own opinion into it, is having read stuff and even going through like the old stuff with Pike and these other guys, and just their saying, you know, that they they believe in the spirit of it, but that there's no physical connection to it. You know, that there's no link to it. And actually, an interesting thing that I made a note of in a book that I had from Manly P. Hall, who's probably not the best historian on this stuff, but he actually mentions a conference that was held in Germany many, many years ago, back in the 1700s, where Freemasons gathered then. In 1782, came to the conclusion that there was no connection to it.
Yeah, that,
but it just seems a self-perpetuating idea that we just keep wanting it to be funny.
I'm glad you brought that up. That's what Hall was talking about, is the convention that was held at Wilhelmsbad, and I'm probably massacring the German language there. But this kind of was at the end of von Hund's Rite of Strict Observance. This started with a guy named Bieberstein, who had a couple of lodges in the late 1740s. They were Masonic lodges. But what they did was they had all of the members adopt French Crusader names. And that was kind of the start of this Templarism idea. And then von Hund got involved, and then some crackpots got involved who kept popping up out of the woodwork saying, we have the real mystical secrets of the Templars. And it all and I go over this in the book. It all came to a head in 1783, where they said enough is enough. They just discredited the idea that there was any, that the Freemasons were the heirs of the Templars.
Yeah.
And you know, it's a really interesting chapter of Masonic history, because there was all kinds of guys just popping up saying, "We know the secrets."
I'm actually reading a book, and we're going to have a guest in a few weeks who we're going to talk about it. Cagliostro, the great count in that same era, talk about that same thing, who had the Egyptian rite at time, the same thing. It's absolutely just what you described. There were these guys popping up all over the place, and I have no doubt that that's where this mystery began and really started to perpetuate itself. And I think in new form, it's given us some good traction. I don't think that it's necessarily a negative to think that we are similar to the Templars in the sense of trying to be chivalrous, but I think it's when we try to put these illusions on of this history of it that we run into trouble.
Here's the interesting thing, and this is what I kind of conclude my book with. The Templars, the original Templars, lasted for less than 200 years. If you take a date of 1791 as the real beginning of Masonic Templarism as we know it, we've outlasted that. And we've gone through a lot of struggles to outlast that. We don't need to hang on to the myth any longer, because we have our own heritage right within the confines of Freemasonry. That's admirable.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I agree. I tend to agree. I know in some of our listening audience, they're asking and talking about some of these important things, you know, the origin of Freemasonry and it still being in a mystery. And I think it's absolutely true. And I think in that mystery, we seek to try to make these connections and create validation to it, you know, instead of celebrating that mystery. Which is interesting. So some of the side topics. This one was actually one of Dean's favorites. The mystery of Oak Island. Do you think
let's have a little
bit there
for it?
wouldn't have anything to do with geographical location, would it?
Just because it's 20 minutes from my house doesn't mean anything.
Well, you know, Dean had some interesting ideas though too, because of some odd architecture that exists in the area. You want to talk about your pentagonal buildings there, Dean?
Well, they're just foundations now, like rock foundations, and they have no idea where these things came from. They are at the top of a hill. They don't overlook anything other than the coastline. They're pentagonal in shape, and I was going to send some pictures to Stephen before the show, but I didn't, because of other things in my life taking priority, I couldn't do that, but... no one has any idea what these rock piles and things are really for. No one talks about them here. They're protected, listed amongst the province as archaeologically important, but not promoted in any way to the locals, kind of hidden so they aren't destroyed. So I can't even really tell you where they are, because that would promote the destruction of them more than anything.
Canadian national secret.
Yeah,
it is. We kind of go far afield on it, but I mean, mean, really, even in your research, Stephen, have you come across anything that even remotely makes you think that Oak Island's of any significance?
Here's my take, and I'm going to preface this by saying I'm not in any way an expert on the history of Oak Island. The idea that the Templars were involved is a relatively new idea. Possibly Stephen Sora's book, came out in 95, 97. Maybe going back a little further with a guy named Michael Bradley writing in the 1980s. So in terms of theories, it's relatively new. I'll say this. The idea that the Templars, when they were persecuted in 1307, 701 years ago tomorrow, that they hopped on board their ships and sailed for North America is a load of crap. Here's why. After Acre fell in 1291, the Hospitallers took on a more naval role because they were trying to conquer the island of Rhodes. At that time, they had four, maybe five ships. This according to historians. The Templars had less. And the ships that they did have, I don't believe were of the type that could have made a transatlantic flight.
Well, what about the idea then that that pirates back then were actually Templars, with the skull and crossbones and that sort of thing? There's a theory that they were Templars in disguise or something.
And we go into that. The Templars simply did not have the number of ships that these guys make claims. The biggest thing, and a lot of listeners will be familiar with this, is the idea that just before the arrests in 1307, 18 galleys set sail from the port of La Rochelle in the middle of the night. This whole thing comes to us from the trials of the Templars. It is evidence given by a man who was against the Templars to begin with and who was basing his information not on first-hand knowledge, but on second-hand knowledge. And we've built this whole mythos that the Templars became pirates out of the idea of these 18 galleys, which historians find implausible that they could have had that many ships, given that the Hospitallers had four or five at the same time, and they were involved in naval warfare. So it doesn't stack up. The skull and crossbones as a flag, I have found no evidence to support that whatsoever.
Because everything's hidden at Oak Island, eh?
Well, I think they buried it in Oak Island.
That's
maybe
right.
I'm going to throw this out because Robert Cooper's book that I talked about earlier, we talk about all these gravestones in Scotland with the skull and crossbones on it, and these are proof of a Masonic tombstone. Cooper photographed the back of a couple of these, and they were actually graves of women. So they certainly weren't Masonic. The skull and crossbones was a common emblem to put on a tombstone at the time.
I would agree with that. You are, however, to counter that, I would say that. Am I making sense here? Can you guys hear me?
Yeah, go for it, man.
Okay, I don't know. I heard some background noise there. On some of the flags of pirates, you will actually see some of the. This then cross references back to our conversation about the Knights Templar not being connected to Masonry, but you saw some actual Masonic arm positions on some of these flags and things like that, and that was kind of interesting.
Well, the symbols and this is kind of a thing that I bring up on symbolism and esoteric ideas. We have a tendency to see a symbol and then interpret it our own way. Let's say I go to McDonald's and I look at the golden arches. As a Freemason, if I want to see that as two side-by-side beehives, and I take away from that... No, I'm serious here. And I
oh,
take
my God.
I'll
never think of McDonald's the same now, Steve.
Okay, but if I take away from that the philosophy and the teaching of the beehive in Freemasonry, that's cool. But if I walk away saying, I told you Ronald McDonald was a Freemason, then you're taking it too far.
You start drawing associations with it. You're starting to build things out of it.
And I think that's what we do with the idea that pirates Templar. Now, having said that, there was a Templar named Roger LaFleur who became kind of a mercenary after the dissolvement of the order. So, you know, you've got a loose connection there. But to draw that and make a parallel line right down to Blackbeard, there's no evidence to support it.
Well,
here's the other thing, and I'd really like to cover this too if I can. You know, the idea that the Templars would take all of their wealth, travel to Nova Scotia, and bury it in a pit just flies in the face of everything that these guys did. First of all, their wealth was not in hoarded gold. Their wealth was in land assets. And that's really what Philip LaBelle was after. I mean, the Templars were making tons of money, you know, growing crops, tending sheep, making wool, having mills to grind the grain. That's where the wealth was. And he felt if you confiscate that, then you can sell the land and raise revenue or make revenue from the land. That's where the wealth was. It wasn't in stored gold.
Just like in politics today, follow the money, you know?
Where were the assets?
Absolutely. With that in mind, though, I, and I'm curious, and this is, again, going far afield, but what do you think about their ideas and the connections to Bamafet? And I'm sorry, I'm blowing the name totally. I've never been able to pronounce it, but...
Well, he's your leader. You don't even know how to say his name. I am offended.
it's another one of those French things. It's Baphomet is how, if you drink Starbucks, that's probably how you pronounce it, but... Baphomet, it's another myth. When you look at the transcripts of the trials, Baphomet is mentioned once or maybe twice. There's lots of references and accusations about worshipping an idol. But the idea that it was this, you know, goat-headed demon that Eliphas Levi drew, it's simply not there. The Templars, like other religious orders, had their relics. There was a group of Templars that were charged with guarding the true cross. This was a relic believed to be the cross that Christ was crucified on. You know, in reality, there were so many pieces of the true cross floating around that you probably could have built Noah's Ark out of it. But, they had this relic, and they would carry it into battle, and a group of 10 Templars was charged with guarding it. If they had... some people have said that Baphomet was really the Holy Grail. If they had the Holy Grail, don't you think they would have trotted that out once in a while?
Because for all the world to see, absolutely.
Well, no, because any relic that a military order had was power, because these people believed that these things would lead them to success in battle.
Yeah, and I wonder, and just even linking this, the whole Masonic Templar thing again, the whole idea of secrecy, having it there but not necessarily flaunting it or showing it, but just the knowledge that it's there. You know, you put a garrison of guys in a place and say something's in there, is going to be powerful. People are going to, well, why are you stationed, 10, 15, 20, 100 people to protect something that no one can see?
But,
you know,
but
it builds that mystery of it.
But in the case of the true cross, it wasn't a secret. I mean, it's right in their rules of order, their constitution, if you will. You know, these 10 Templars that were stationed at Jerusalem, they were charged with guarding it. They had some other duties as well. But, I mean, that must have been, it was like an honor guard. It was an important position. So
there were 10 guys guarding a piece of rotting wood, is what you're saying.
Well, I mean, this thing obviously would have been decorated to the hilt, and it was actually captured by Saladin at the Battle of Hattin in 1187. It was an important relic. Now, they had other relics, too. They had the skull of Saint Eurasia, and that was confiscated during the trials. And there's nothing absurd about that. The bones of saints, hey, the more you had, the better. I mean, it was like Pokemon.
Yeah.
These people,
That's definitely something that we tend to forget was the superstitions of the age and just how they operated. These things were key to them.
And see, that's the mistake I think that a lot of contemporary writers make. We want to look at history through the eyes of modern eyes, and you can't do that. You know, you have to look at it through how people thought at the time.
Yep. I totally agree with that. Well, all right. So I think we've probably beaten this with the half inch of its life. I mean, I'm curious, and just as a last sort of aspect of it, how do you see these other Templar orders that exist today, the non-Masonic ones? Do you think any of them really have any sort of lineage back to the real Templars, or again, are they all just manifestations today of these ideals?
Any thoughts to that? Despite what and it seems like every other week some new Templar organization is popping up suing the Vatican for this thing or that, claiming to be the real deal. We have the Masonic Knights Templar, who have been around since the mid-1700s in one form or another. We have the Sovereign Military Order of the Temple of Jerusalem. It's a non-Masonic chivalric order that admits men and women. They do great charitable work. They've been around for a long time, officially since 1804. Some may claim earlier. I know that early on in their history, they claimed a direct line of descent. Are you familiar with the Larmenius Charter?
Not offhand.
Okay, this is a document claims that when de Molay, the last Grand Master of the Templars, was in prison, he passed the reins to a man named John Mark Larmenius, who carried the order on in secret until 1804, when the order went public. And it has a list of Grand Masters, kind of along the line, the Priory of Sion, and, a list of masters. Now, some people give it credence, others don't. I don't buy it. But I don't think today the Sovereign Military Order, I don't think they hold to that idea any longer. And I think they're a legitimate homage to the Templars of old in the same way that the Masonic Templars are. But I don't think there's any order today that can claim a direct line of descent.
I can really link it back. Any that you think that do it better than the others? Any of the knightly orders? Or, is there really a way of doing it better? Or... I guess even in comparison to the Masonic Knights Templar, do you see one process over the other, or?
It's all a matter of perspective. I can't really comment on the SMOTJ because I'm not a member, and although I know some things about them, I'm not actively involved, so I can't say. I respect them. I respect what they do. I respect what the Masonic Templars are trying to do, but like all Masonic orders. Are we really living up to what these cats were trying to set out to do? Masonic Templarism in Canada and the United Kingdom is vastly different than it is in the United States. And I'm not saying this one way or the other, but in the United States, Masonic Templarism is much closer to craft masonry. There's a deeper connection there than what we have in Canada. In Canada, the connection between the two is only in that you have to be a Royal Archmason to join. Also, Masonic Templarism in the United States is much more militaristic. I mean, you've got guys in hot wool suits marching in parking lots in the middle of summer doing drill work. And as impressive as that is, we simply don't get into that in Canada.
Sorry? Well, I always said take it from a different aspect. That's essentially the difference between the two.
Even the religious requirements. In Canada, one must profess a belief in the doctrine of the Holy and Undivided Trinity, Christian Trinity. And so it's very much Trinitarian Christian. Whereas in the United States, there is some question as to whether or not one actually has to be a Christian to join. And that's a gray area that that you know is kind of handled at a state level, whether
yeah.
overtly or covertly, and that's probably enough said on that.
To each their own in discovering that as they take that path.
But the point being that they're vastly different. But who's to say who's doing it right?
Right.
You know, I think what's important is that you know we pay homage to the memory of what these guys did. You know, their faith in Christianity, their faith to an ideal, their faith to a concept.
Absolutely. To take it to a little bit of a different direction here, and I know there's a lot of interest in the Templars, and I'm sure we could do the remainder of our time on it, I did want to talk a little bit more about your contemporary stuff, and even starting a little bit back in just my first introduction to Stephen Defoe, I wanted to talk about Masonic Magazine. And for those that are listening now and who don't have a memory of it, if the website's still up, it's MasonicMagazine.com. I'm just curious, and I don't want to go too deep, but what happened? It was I loved this little magazine that came. Was it quarterly?
Masonic Magazine was actually my second crack at the bat, if you will, of publishing a Masonic periodical. The first one was called A Fourth Part of a Circle, taken a reference from the Canadian Rite ritual. It didn't do too well. You know, it just never caught on. You know, get into the reasons for that, but the fact is it didn't catch on. And I thought maybe the title is too esoteric, particularly with an American audience that might not be familiar with the reference. So I thought, let's grind her up and do this again. We'll make it as simple as possible. We'll call it Masonic Magazine. Doesn't get any simpler than that. I think probably at our high point, we had 400 subscribers worldwide. You know, maybe selling another 100 copies or so, single issue. People didn't buy it. And so, you know, so like any business venture, you look at that and go, well, we're not losing money, but we're not making money. So But you can frown on that, but let's look at what the publication did in 8 issues. The average magazine doesn't last a year. We lasted 2 years. We are probably, and I say we because it really was a team effort putting this thing out. You know, Fred Milliken, God bless him, he did a column every issue.
But don't get started.
What we did... that I don't think any other Masonic publication that I'm aware of has done, is we paid our writers. We didn't pay them a lot, but we paid them something. We validated the worth of their writing. And as a result of that, we were able to pick and choose what we published. You know, we could say, you know what, this, I'm not going to pay for this because it's crap. Don't publish it. Or if it was something, we could send it back and say, we need you to alter this to make it better.
Yeah.
So I'm not saying it was the greatest thing since sliced bread, but I'm proud of what the magazine did, and I'm proud of the writing that our writers did.
Absolutely. Go ahead.
But at the end of the day, it was a break-even proposition, and, you know, as a business person, you need to put that money where it's going to make a return on the investment.
You know, and I completely hear that. Dean and I talk that conversation constantly. In pointing out one of the things from the magazine, I recollect in a lot of circles, even reading the magazine, just talking about the depth of literature that's out there, and the lament that there's not enough emphasis on education and people picking these things up and reading them, and I can imagine. I remember early on and just hearing some of the laments at the, you know, readership being low, and it was my concern. It's like, oh, I didn't want to see it go away, but it's certainly a shame. Do you still have them for sale? Are they still offered at any of your sites?
No, I have very few of the print versions. Now, you can download copies of it. You can download electronic copies at a, you know, dirt cheap price.
Gotcha.
You know, I had thought of making a volume 1 and a volume 2 that would combine the 4 issues of each volume, but I'm probably not going to do that.
Interesting. That might be something to publish.
Yeah.
That might actually be an interesting publication.
Well, I'm thinking...
Right.
I'm thinking that if the original issues didn't sell, these won't either. So, you know, it's there for download. People can download it cheap, and I think there's some damn good material in there.
Right. Yeah, I think we should move on to my exciting part. I want to really start talking about his next venture, if you wouldn't mind.
That was actually next on my list here. So
my hands are open together.
So Stephen, tell us about and I'm going to get it right this time, Dean. Tell us about Autre Mer, the new graphic novel that you've been working on that's coming out November 1st.
Autre Mer,
huh, Dean? Tell us about it, Stephen.
Okay.
Just to preface it, we were joking before the call. I butchered the name, so anybody who's listening, I called it Outreamer, which is probably a very American extension of it. It's true pronunciation is Autre Mer, and I'm sure if you walked into a comic book shop and asked for Outreamer, they're going to recognize it anyways. So, but you can ask for Autre Mer. So tell us about Autre Mer, Stephen. Just in looking at it, the little five-page preview that you had, you actually have it up for pre-sale at TemplarComics.com.
Yep.
The little five-page preview looks very nice.
Thank you. The comic was drawn by an Edmonton professional artist named Bob Prodor. Bob knew nothing about the Templars when he started the project with me. I gave him a ton of reference material, and he worked his guts out for 7 months drawing this thing to be as historically accurate as he could. Now, we've taken some liberties for artistic concept. This is an idea that I had probably 3 years ago. I've been a comic geek since I was old enough to read. Already talked about Batman and my obsession with that stuff. And I thought, you know, it'd be really cool to take the story of the Templars into a new audience, into a non-traditional audience. It is a comic book. It's not a graphic novel. A graphic novel is what the media, grown-up people in the media, call comic books because they're embarrassed to say comic book.
I didn't want to make any assumptions.
It's a comic. It's a common reference, but a graphic novel would be, let's say a 100-page illustrated book that wasn't published as single issues. I will combine Autre Mer as what we call trade paperbacks. The first story will take 4 issues to tell. So I'll combine that down the road into a trade paperback, but it'll be done in single issues. It's the first story arc is the story of the origins of the Knights Templar, historically accurate, but fictionally told. Yeah, there's a fair amount of action. I think the first 3 pages you can see in the preview, there's quite a bit of action packed into those pages.
Is it like a Rambo movie?
No. The first 4 issues tell the story of Hugh de Payens and Geoffrey de Saint-Omer and how they had this idea of protecting pilgrims, but there wasn't enough of them. And it's what they did to get the ball rolling to form the group that would become the Templars. The first issue has a lot of flashbacks to the First Crusade and what happened in that. And in the setting of the story, I've made de Payens a participant in the First Crusade. Historically, we don't know for a fact whether he was involved or not. There's a possibility. So that's why I say it's historically accurate, but fictionally told.
How was it changing gears from writing a novel into writing a script-based graphic novel, script-based comic? Was it much of a departure from what you've done in the past?
Yeah, it's really really hard because you know when you write a nonfiction book, you know you've got your chapters set out and you follow a flow. And writing a book is like writing a series of essays that are linked at the end of the chapter. One essay leads into the other. That's
yep.
Short. When you're writing a comic book, you're writing a script, the dialogue has to move, the story, the pacing has to move, pages have to move from one to other, and you have to tell the story visually, and you have to write a script in a fashion that a guy like Bob Prodor, who knows nothing about the Templars, is able to follow. And to put his own stamp on it. And he made some changes. He made some visual changes to the script that just blew my mind.
Go ahead.
Yeah, no, he really did a fantastic job on it. Originally, I was going to do the book in black and white. Then I decided to do it in full color. But being as cheap as I am, I didn't want to hire a colorist. So I taught myself how to do it. And so that's been a learning curve, because it takes approximately a full day to color one page digitally.
Yeah, well, as long as you're not colorblind, I guess you're okay. It's
one of those things, I think, that you don't appreciate the amount of work that goes into it until you put the amount of work that goes into it, and it blows you away.
It took me a week or so to write the script. It took Bob 7 months to draw and ink it. And it's, going to take me another couple of months to completely color it. Or from beginning, it's almost done now. It's almost ready to go to press.
So let me ask a question. What's a normal comic? How many people do you normally have drawing a comic? You have one guy drawing a comic. Isn't there usually when they do these?
No.
Like, how?
No. It depends. It varies. But ordinarily today, you'll have one guy who does the pencils, one guy who does the inks, commonly referred to as a tracer. You have to watch Kevin Smith movies to get that reference. then you'll have the person who does the coloring, which is generally done digitally today. Then you'll have another person that does the lettering in the word balloons. And then you may have somebody else do the cover, and somebody else ink the cover, and somebody else color the cover. And with some comics, you may have as many as a half dozen different covers. So
yeah.
And then you have an editor, and then you have a group editor. So it's a pretty big
deal. It's a monumental amount of work. And you're clearing house all of this through what publisher? Are you the publishing house for this also?
I'm just me. Yeah, this is just something I'm doing on my own. I'm going to market it, obviously, through TemplarHistory.com and to people that are into the Templars. But I'll probably, after the initial run, I'll probably distribute it through a company called Diamond, who supply all the comic book shops in North America. They put out a catalog every month that's like 500 pages of just stuff that makes us comic geeks drool. And so comic shops will be able to order it. So
anything that we can do as a listener, should we call our local comic shop and tell them to make sure they carry it? Or
sure, you can. It'll probably be several months before it's in previews. Before I solicit it to the comic shops, I'd like to have two or three issues in the bag.
Yep,
just that far ahead. A big problem with comics today, and I'm talking big companies like DC and Marvel, is that they're continuously late with their product. I mean, it can be three, 4 months between issues, and that's
wow. Has it really gotten that bad? I had to kick my comic book habit a long time ago. It was getting to be way too much, so
yeah.
I just stopped cold turkey. Have they really? Has their scheduling gotten that bad?
In some cases, I mean, you're familiar with Frank Miller? He's the guy that wrote Sin City.
Oh yeah.
And directed the movie 300, or was involved in 300, or wrote the thing for 300. He's doing a Batman comic these days with a popular artist named Jim Lee, and I think they brought out two issues in a year and a half. I mean, just ridiculous.
Wow. Egads. Wow, that's terrible. That's absolutely terrible.
But you know what? If you're Frank Miller and Jim Lee, you can be a year and a half between issues. If you're Stephen Daple and Bob Prodor, you need to be a little more regular.
So we're
eating a lot of bran, and we're doing our best.
I must ask this, because we're talking to a target audience here of Masons, and the average Mason, doesn't go to comic book shops. Is there a way that they will be able to order this without having to walk in and look like a pedophile at the comic book store?
That's a rather bizarre reference, man. I'm not sure what
If you
walk into a comic store these days, the average age is probably 30.
Old guys just like us.
No, seriously, I mean, comic books aren't written for children anymore. I mean, there are some, but you buy those at Barnes & Noble on a spinning rack.
Yeah,
you know, they can order the comic directly from TemplarComics.com. They can pre-order it, and they'll get a copy signed by Bob and I that'll be numbered, individually numbered. We're limiting that to 1,000 copies.
Can you give me number one? Can you give me number one?
If I'm not mistaken, it's also they do PayPal on there, do they not? Are you taking PayPal orders?
Oh, absolutely. It's the only way to fly.
So, yeah. So anybody listening, definitely check out TemplarComics.com. It's the place to order Outremer. Any other projects? Oh, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say there's a one-minute trailer, like a little movie trailer for the comic, and there's a five-page preview, so you can check out the first five pages.
Yeah, definitely good to look at. Any other projects, Stephen? Anything that's going on, books or any other websites coming up?
No new websites at the moment. I've obviously, like any book writer, you've got several proposals out in the field that you're trying to get bought. I've got, I can't really talk about any of them. The one I can talk about is a book on the William Morgan affair. I just had this, just came out, Heardom, Scottish Rite Transactions, Volume 15. They did a 50,000 word piece of mine on the Morgan affair.
How many words? 50,000?
50,000. Yeah, I think it's about 50,000. It's something like 77 pages of this volume. I didn't know enough to shut up.
that's a pretty good amount of words there talking about it. That's a whole other topic, too.
What it is, really, it's kind of a combination of the four-part series I did for Masonic Magazine on the abduction and possible murder of Morgan. But it carries on from there with the ramifications of what happened after Freemasonry came back and how nobody really remembered the degree work anymore.
Interesting. I have picked that up in some of the older books that I have talking about it, how the system almost evaporated completely in some states. Interesting. That actually might be something fun to talk about coming up, and maybe we can have you back on it. I say that way just because I think we've come to the top of our hour. Dean's usually my champion on the clock for me, but I guess he's...
I thought you were watching it, okay? But I wasn't going to stop him while he was talking about his magazine, his comic. I mean, it would be like... You know, it wouldn't be very polite of me. But, yeah, we should be wrapping up now, about now, Greg.
I hear you.
Hang on. Kennedy, for the second time tonight, has said I've talked too much.
That's correct.
It's an East Coast Canadian thing. Stephen, let me just say thanks so much for being here. This is great to be able to dig into this and it not necessarily be... a website or something else to have to try to just pull, you know, extract the conversation from. This is great talking to you. I've followed your work for a long time, and I'm really glad that I had the opportunity to meet you and talk about this stuff with you.
Oh, I've enjoyed it, and I have to say, you know, I've listened to a few of your shows now, just prior to prepare for tonight's show, and I'm really impressed with what you guys have done. You guys are doing what I was trying to do with Radio Freemason, at least the interview portion. Just have an informal, you know, cool time talking to interesting people.
It's trying to encapsulate the best part of Lodge, the ability to just try to talk. To have somebody of a common interest and to talk about it. Absolutely. I know Dean and I are constantly wondering what exactly it is we're doing.
Yeah. Any ideas yet?
Nope, not a clue. I don't want to answer that yet, though, because as soon as we answer it, the whole thing will just hit the skids. I'm teasing. Hey, Stephen, thanks. Let me just hit a couple of your websites real quick. For the author, Stephen Defoe, you can read up on him at Stephen Defoe. That's with a PH. So StephenDefoe.com. For Templar history, anybody who wants to dig in more, and even they've got some great message boards, is TemplarHistory.com. Masonic Dictionary is a fantastic site. I'm very impressed with all the work that's gone into that to extract and pull and assemble that. And the newest for Outremer, the TemplarComics.com. That's TemplarComics.com. So So anybody who's listening now, tonight, or even down the line, take a look at it. You can order your copies. I'm going to order mine tonight so that nobody gets me out of that first 1,000 to get the signed copy. So you guys, anything I missed, Stephen? Is there any other websites or anything else that you wanted to mention?
If anyone's got my Christmas list up, I do. I want one.
maybe I'll order one for you there, Dean. I guess thanks, Stephen. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure. It's really good talking to you. Just a heads up for anybody listening, we have coming up on the show next week on the 19th, Jessica Harlan Jacobs, who is the author, which I just received from Amazon the other day, Builders of Empire,
good
Freemasonry
book.
And British Imperialism, 1717 to 1927. I've barely started to get through it. This is a phenomenal book. She is a PhD out of Florida, if I'm not mistaken, and Brother Tim Bryce will be here talking to her with us, as he's had her come and talk at their lodges, which is very good. And then also on the 26th, we have Brother Tom Jackson coming. Tom's a phenomenal guy to talk to, and he's as at home as you can imagine, and wise beyond imagine just in talking to him. And the precursors for the show, we spent an hour essentially doing a show, just talking. So. He's coming up on the 26th, and then as we roll into November, we have a full slate. We have Robert Davis coming to us out of Oklahoma, Brent Morris coming to us out of Washington. We are taking a little bit of a dip in diving into alchemy with Brother Timothy Hogan, and then on the 23rd, we have Chris Hodapp. And then we'll keep 30th, we have Pip Fox coming too. So we'll talk about more of those. You can check out our regular schedule at MasonicCentral.com or keep your eyes open at TalkShoe, and you'll see upcoming shows as we start loading them in there.
And don't forget our new Facebook group, Greg.
Oh, our new Facebook group. Look for us on Facebook.
Masonic
Central, isn't it? Man, there's just too much. There's just, you can't have a baby, Dean. I'm sorry. Tell your wife to send it back.
I'm expecting Stephen to sign up for our Facebook group.
I'm doing it right now.
Look for us on Facebook also. We're moving. We're moving and shaking here. Stephen, thanks again for being here. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And I'm sure we'll be talking again. Well, as you get closer to this William Morgan publication, let's definitely talk. That would be fun to come in and talk about. I know a lot of brothers have heard the anti-Masonic party but have no clue what it's tied to.
And you know what might also be interesting? There's can I just throw in a plug here? There's a Mason named Robert Berry, who also just recently wrote a book about the Morgan Affair. In fact, I just finished reading it last week. It's a good book. He, like myself, hasn't been able to find a publisher yet, so he published it himself through one of these different print-on-demand outfits. And I wish I had the address off the top of my head, but maybe just, you know, Google Robert Berry and Morgan Affair, and maybe it'll come up. It's a book worth reading, and it might be cool to have him and I do it, because, you know, nobody's written about this stuff in, you know, seriously in 100 years, probably. And I was really impressed with his book.
I am making a note of that right now.
And for those of you that want to know the Oak Island connection to the Templars and the Holy Grail, they can listen, or they can read the Holy Grail Across the Atlantic. There's my piece. And I don't know the author's name right offhand, but you can find him if you look on it. Anyway, at that, Greg, we should just remind the listeners that they can always wait until the show is over and we'll finish talking. You can ask questions if he sticks around to our guest, and we do this every show. We encourage people to come in and participate live on the show.
Our local parking lot chat.
And Greg, how about we take this away now so we can take it to the background.
I think we're ready to go. This is Greg Stewart saying thanks for being here, and this is my fellow host,
Dean Kennedy, saying,
and we're saying travel light. Oh man.